can proceed.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Cochran, and Judge Clary. The Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this March 10, 2022 panel of the Court of Appeals. We are entertaining our third and final oral argument today, which is FKS Enterprises versus, I hope I don't mispronounce it, it's either Webby or Webby. I'm going to guess it's Webby, and you can correct me if I'm wrong about that. Each side will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel to use for rebuttal if you would like. Please be aware that even though we can see each other and we're on Zoom today, we are making only an audio recording of the proceedings, so please state your name as you commence each leg of the argument and alert us if there's any glitchiness or technological issues that you perceive as the argument progresses so we can pause the proceedings and get the technology sorted out. And with that, counsel for appellant, whenever you are ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Thank you, Judge Ross. Good morning, and may it please the court. Sarah Crippen on behalf of appellants Pampas One LLC and Matthew Webby. You got it right, Judge Ross. I want to talk primarily about the findings of fraud and corporate veil piercing today and focus at the beginning on the standard of review. We would submit that the inescapable conclusion, if you read the record, is that the district court made profound mistakes in its findings of fact and ignoring evidence, and that it misapplied the law of fraud, the independent duty rule, and the law relating to corporate veil piercing. We are not challenging credibility determinations made by the district court. To the contrary, we find ourselves in the unusual position of asking this court to believe the plaintiffs, Farm King, and their counsel, and to correct the fact that the court ignored dispositive admissions and other testimony by Farm King, its principals, and its attorneys in issuing a decision that, in addition to finding contract violations in the form of breach of contract, breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing, taking the same facts and using those facts to enter judgments of fraud and corporate veil piercing. So I want to focus initially on the facts that Farm King's own witnesses testified to. They are undisputed and, in our view, dispositive. The Farm King principals testified that Mr. Webby at no time indicated, and they at no time understood, that Mr. Webby was going to be acting in his personal capacity. From the beginning of their negotiations into the middle of 2018, there is an understanding by Farm King that Mr. Webby would be acting through corporate entities, LLCs, in this transaction. That becomes very significant when you look at the case law surrounding fraud, and in particular, the corporate veil piercing. They knew that the LLC buyers were, as the district court put it, shell entities, and they were, as their lawyers put it, not creditworthy. The district court at addendum 112 to 113, in describing the significance of the contract language, says that contract language representing financial capability was very significant because we knew we were dealing with shell entities. Farm King knew that there was a contract risk entering into agreements with these LLCs, with Flower and Crabapple and Pampas. That's why their very sophisticated lawyers tenaciously worked to get a personal guarantee. They knew that without a personal guarantee, all they had was the negotiated contract, which was with LLCs that both the district court and the lawyers for Farm King knew were startup, single-purpose LLCs that Farm King understood would receive assets as part of this transaction. The court should believe Mr. Williamson, the lead attorney on the deal for Farm King, when he said, "We might walk away from this deal if we don't have a personal guarantee." They should believe, the court should believe Mr. Williamson and Mr. Sievers, his client, when they said, "We considered walking away, but we got comfortable and decided to do the deal because we had language in the stock purchase agreement that said these entities had financial capability. The court should believe trial counsel and all of Farm King's witnesses when they said that the agreements, the stock purchase agreement, which has that financial capability representation, also applied to Pampas One LLC as the buyer under the real estate purchase agreement. This undisputed testimony from Farm King is entirely ignored by the district court and entirely ignored by Farm King in its briefing to this court. There is no reliance here on anything other than the contract with known parties, known to be shells as the district court called them, to be not creditworthy as the lawyers for Farm King called them. These facts defeat both the fraud and the corporate veil piercing conclusions of the district court. So starting with fraud, I want to briefly touch on fraud in the inducement. Farm King urges a fraud in the inducement theory now because it gets them out from under the independent duty rule, which I'll talk about and admit it in a minute. The district court doesn't say a single word about fraud in the inducement, mind you, doesn't cite a single case about fraud in the inducement. And the district court did the same thing back in March of 2020 when defendants moved for judgment on the pleadings on the independent duty rule. The district court dismissed the fraud claims against Flower and Crabapple based on that language in the stock purchase agreement about fraudulent representations, and based on the fact that no closing would happen without the contract. The district court said you can't have fraud when you have that contract language. Farm King argued fraud in the inducement then. The district court ignored it and said, no, these fraud claims are dismissed under the independent duty rule. The second thing
also,
that...
Just to clarify, you said that the district court didn't analyze fraud in the inducement. Looking at the addendum at page 120, well, starting at 119, but particularly at 120, there is a discussion of intent to induce and reliance. And then on 121, an analysis pointing to the facts. And then a conclusion on 123 that the greater weight of the evidence establishes that Webby directly participated in the fraud by making false statements that plaintiffs relied on while knowing the statements were false. So can you clarify for me when you say the district court didn't analyze fraud in the inducement, what you mean?
Thank you, Judge Cochran. What I meant by that is, although the district court says in parts of its order that there was reliance by Farm King and that they were induced to, you know, enter into that based on those statements, the record evidence is that Farm King itself said through Brad Sievers, the statements we relied on were the contract statements, section 7.05 of the stock purchase agreement. He doesn't talk about relying on the statements before. He says we relied completely on the contract statements. The other piece, you mentioned reliance. The other piece that I think defeats the fraud in the inducement claim is the undisputed fact.
No, just to be clear, I gather then you're arguing something other than legal conclusions. You're arguing that the district court clearly erred in its determination of reliance. And I don't see that argument developed in your brief. I thought your brief was purely a legal, based upon the legal proposition that you're asserting.
We are also arguing that the district court made errors in its factual findings by ignoring entirely the facts that I just described that go to all of this being a contract issue, reliance completely on the contracts, which is briefed in our briefing, and the admissions by Farm King that they understood what these entities were. The findings are fundamentally flawed, and this infects the conclusions of law as well, in
so
that they ignore that testimony.
So when I read appellant's brief, I didn't see a challenge to it in your brief. That I'm looking at page 26 in the appellant's brief, which asserts the district court found and appellants do not appear to challenge the finding that Webby made multiple specific false representations to Farm King about his ability to complete a purchase of Farm King's business, and that he had more than enough equity on the transaction. So you're saying that that is a, that you are in fact challenging the fact, the finding?
We are challenging the fact that that is what the Farm King relied on. And I think this is fully briefed. It's clear that what Farm King relied on was not those statements, but rather completely on the contracts, as Brad Sievers testified. That's also demonstrable by the undisputed facts that all of those statements were made. We argued to the district court they were too generalized to be fraud, and we haven't challenged that on appeal. Mr. Webby says this is a layup, it's a slam dunk. It is clear from the record that, and from the admissions of the Farm King witnesses, that they did not rely on that. They didn't trust it. They didn't believe it. Because when they started to negotiate the contract, their very sophisticated counsel began to tenaciously work for a personal guarantee and said, we know that these entities are not creditworthy. We need someone creditworthy to step in. And the testimony of Mr. Williamson and Mr. Sievers is they got comfortable because they had the language in Section 7.5 of the stock purchase agreement. Both Mr. Williamson and Mr. Sievers testified to that, and that is entirely ignored by the district court. We would submit that fraud in the inducement is not what we're talking about here. And I would note as well, the district court, again, back in March of 2020, did not find fraud in the inducement sufficient to defeat the independent duty rule when it came to the stock purchase agreement applying to Flowering Crabapple. It said, you've got this representation in the contract, and so the independent duty rule applies. There's no reason that shouldn't apply here.
Your suggestion that the district court was bound to that conclusion, and even though there'd been no appeal, there's no application of the rule of the case law, and the district court couldn't revisit that issue?
I suppose they could have, Your Honor, but they didn't. The district court did not revisit that. And so there is no finding of fraud against Flowering Crabapple, because back in March of 2020, the district court said Flowering Crabapple can't be held liable for fraud because they made a representation in a contract. And that ruling
was
not
only as to Flowering Crabapple.
Correct. And the only fraud judgment that was entered here is against Pampas under the court's erroneous finding that the independent duty rule didn't apply to Pampas. And that's where we get back into, I want you to believe what the Farm King witnesses said, which was, the stock purchase agreement and the real estate purchase agreement were integrated, and we relied on the language that's in the stock purchase agreement as to both Flowering Crabapple and Pampas. So the contract applied, both that contract language applied to both of them. The district court does the same thing. The very facts that the district court used to hold Pampas and Flowering Crabapple liable for breach of contract are the same facts that the district court relies upon to establish fraud and to argue and to pierce the corporate veil.
Counsel, but there can follow up on that point.
Pardon me?
Your earlier point about relying on the guarantee in the contract that there'd be sufficient funds, and your argument that the stock purchase agreement's related to the real estate purchase agreement. But that language of 7.05 says buyer has and will have on closing date the financial capability to consummate the transactions. And buyer's Flowering Crab, right?
It is on the stock purchase agreement. The witnesses testified, and this is detailed in our brief, and Mr. Meyer, who was trial counsel for Farm King, said in his opening statement, and Mr. Williamson, the lawyer on the deal, said they were integrated, which is correct under the contracts. Exhibit A to the real estate purchase agreement defines the transaction documents as including both the REPA and the SPA. And Mr. Williamson, the deal lawyer, and Mr. Sievers, the principal for Farm King, both testified to that and said, we viewed them as the same contract, that the real estate purchase, the buyer under the real estate purchase agreement, namely Pampas, also made that financial misrepresentation. And the court holds Pampas liable for breach of contract based on the financial misrepresentation language. When the court then goes to list the fraudulent statements supposedly made by Pampas and Mr. Webby as an officer of Pampas, the first thing it lists is Section 7.05 of the stock purchase agreement, which makes no sense at all. If that statement in the stock purchase agreement signed by Flower and Crabapple constitutes a fraudulent representation by Pampas, then obviously the court is reading that obligation onto Pampas. And as we should all believe they should, because that's exactly what the witnesses said, was that those were combined obligations. As to the piercing of the corporate veil, this is briefed extensively. We would submit that the Farm King has fundamentally failed and the district court failed to identify any real injustice. Everyone knew what Pampas was, that it was a shell entity, not creditworthy. Everyone knew that there is no injustice. It is improper for this court to give a fraud or corporate veil piercing remedy when the breach of contract has already been found to save Farm King from a bad result as a result of its contract negotiations.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal time.
Thank you. And I apologize for going over.
No need to apologize. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Richard Landon, and I represent the respondents in this matter. Appellants have challenged the district court's factual findings about fraud and the court's exercise of its equitable veil-piercing powers. And appellants repeatedly asked this court to dig deep into the trial record, focus on evidence that they think was helpful to their defense, while simply ignoring the evidence that they think was harmful. But the role of this court, of course, is to look for errors below, not to reweigh the evidence and decide whether the court would reach a different conclusion. As is clear from the appendix to appellant's brief, the trial court had an opportunity to consider the evidence and legal arguments about appellant's liability for fraud, no fewer than 4 separate occasions: motion for judgment on the pleadings, motion for summary judgment, a 5-day court trial reviewing hundreds of exhibits and evaluating the credibility of witnesses, and then post-trial motions that included the same arguments that are raised here on appeal. Appellants have not demonstrated an error in the court's findings or an abuse of the court's exercise of its equitable powers. They are simply offering to a new audience the same arguments that failed to persuade the fact finder. This does not clear the high bar on a deferential standard of review, and it doesn't justify reversal in this case. I would like to focus on 2 arguments related to the fraud issue, which appellants focused on in their reply brief and was emphasized by opposing counsel this morning. And that's the element of reasonable reliance and their response to the theory of fraud and the inducement. Starting with reasonable reliance, I agree with Judge Ross that this issue was not actually raised in the appellant's opening brief. Respondents probably would have addressed it differently had they done so, but it is briefed extensively in their reply brief. Appellants argue that there could not have been reasonable reliance because they say Farm King knew that Flowering Crabapple and Pampas did not have any assets as of the date of the SPA and the REPA that they were signed. This simply is not true. An appellant's argument is contrary to the facts and is based on an unreasonable inference about the structure of Webby's companies, not knowledge about Webby's actual finances. Appellants argue that because Farm King knew that Webby had identified single-purpose companies as the buyers, that Farm King must have known that they had no assets. But the fact that an LLC's single purpose is to own the company that it is buying does not necessitate that it has no assets or financing available. In fact, it would be absurd to make that logical leap because no single purpose LLC would ever be able to complete the purchase in the first place. But looking at the facts, Farm King's deal attorney, Mark Williamson, explicitly contradicted appellants on this point. And he noted that he did not know what the buyer's financial arrangements were at the time that they were negotiating the SBA. We cite to the transcript starting on page 133, transcript page 133. I think we cite this on page 46 of our brief. The quote is opposing counsel asked, "And you knew that Flowering Crabapple was not creditworthy by your definition, correct?" And Mr. Williamson answered, "I didn't know at that point. I don't know about his financial arrangements. I don't know if he has access to a line of credit. I don't know." As Williamson's testimony makes clear, Farm King did not know what Webby's intercompany financial arrangements were. Indeed, this is even supported by statements that appellants made while negotiating the financing agreement with Store Capital. And we talk about this on page 15 of our brief, exhibit 43, where they were having to renegotiate or reorganize Mr. Webby's corporate structure to satisfy a lending partner. And the appellant's deal attorney expressly told Store Capital, the lender, that Farm King was not aware of the big R side of the reorganization and instructed Store Capital not to tell Farm King. This is far from the awareness of appellant's financial circumstance.
Right, but I think if I understand Ms. Crippen's argument, it is that not knowing the finances or going further and knowing that there were no funds to support that the organizations had no funds, they were just shell organizations, that therefore it was only the contract on which the seller relied to make the deal, not representations by Mr. Webby. I believe that's the argument.
Your Honor, I believe that Ms. Crippen's argument is that Farm King expressly knew that the buyers had no assets or finances.
I don't know if that affects her. I don't know that affects her argument either way. Let's just, I mean, if whether it is that they knew the entities were unfunded or that they were completely unaware, as you've pointed out, as the testimony suggests, they were unaware of the financial stability of the entities, that either way, the reliance then was on the term in the contract, not on representations made, but only on the contractual promises of financing.
Your Honor, this goes to the second point, the fraud and the inducement point. And I agree that that is what appellants are arguing, but I do not agree that the record supports that argument. Because the court found that Matthew Webby made repeated misrepresentation about his financial ability to purchase. And opposing counsel said that everyone knew that he was not acting in his individual capacity. I think that that's a overgeneralization and a misstatement. Farm King understood that there would be entities purchasing the business. But for much of the negotiation, they did not know which entities it would be. Matthew Webby kept making representations about his purchase of Big R and his ability to leverage Big R.
And in fact, as I understand it, there was a change in the entities during the period after the signing of the contract and the intended closing because of concerns about the financier requiring, according to Mr. Webby, a change in the entities. Am I correct about that?
Yes, that is correct. But I think that importantly, what is clear in the record is that Webby continuously represented to Farm King that it was not a problem, that he had more than enough equity in Big R financing this deal was not going to be a problem. Farm King didn't know what the financing details were. They certainly had no duty to know or obligation to try and find out. It was represented to them that it was not going to be a problem. And whether that was because, you know, T. Olive, the company that owned Big R, had a credit agreement with Flowering Crab Apple, or whether there was some, you know, more complicated arrangement with a lending institution, as we later found out was being negotiated, but we didn't know about at the time. The point is, Farm King had no knowledge that the companies that were on the contract as the buyers would not be able to access funds, contrary to the representations that Mr. Webby had been making. The court noted that these misrepresentations certainly culminated in the representation in the SPA. But this was one consistent representation with many earlier representations. The court noted that Brad Sievers credibly testified that he had 10 or more conversations with Webby, where Webby assured him that there was no issue whatsoever, that he had the ability to do the transaction. Appellants argue that these earlier representations shouldn't matter because they claim, contrary to the court's credibility determinations, that Farm King didn't believe Webby when he made it. And they point to the request for bank letters or personal guarantees as purported evidence that Farm King didn't believe Webby when he said that he could finance the transaction. And therefore, they weren't induced. But this argument is not supported by them.
Counsel, you know, going back to the reasonable reliance argument that was made, that you started out with, did the district court address the facts that Ms. Crippen argues are dispositive in its findings of fact that she argues were ignored by the district court?
I'm not sure.
She listed several facts that she argues the district court ignored that are dispositive. Were those adequately addressed by the district court in its findings of fact?
Well, I think that they were adequately addressed. What I believe appellants are arguing, however, is they are asking for inferences from evidence. It is not that the court ignored the evidence. They think that different inferences should have been addressed. Certainly, I believe that there is more than enough evidence in the record to support the district court's finding and what appellant's burden is under this standard of review is to demonstrate that the findings were clearly erroneous in light of the evidence in the record. And we have certainly identified, contrary evidence in our brief that supports that decision. Returning to the inducement point, which is related to the reasonable reliance.
If you could, before your time expires, go ahead and finish the points you wanted to make on reasonable reliance, but I think it would be helpful if you also can address the veil-piercing conclusion of the district court.
Sure. To quickly finish up on inducement, I would like to state that the district court correctly observed that Farm King's desire for a personal guarantee or bank letter was a sign that it wanted more assurance from Mr. Webby before finalizing the deal. And although Mr. Webby did not provide a bank letter, despite saying he would, and didn't agree to provide a personal guarantee, he did provide that assurance. And in fact, he made the Sievers feel like they were stupid for even asking, which is a fact that the court discussed in its finding. To claim that this is not inducement is like a lumberjack after chopping away at a tree for hours, claiming that it was only the last swing of the axe that felled the tree. Saying that you ultimately prevailed upon a skeptical audience is not a counter to inducement. And it certainly does not show that the district court's finding that Farm King was fraudulently induced was clearly erroneous in light of the record. There is no testimony that Farm King relied exclusively on the SBA. I believe appellants are trying to take the word completely, where Brad Sievers testified that Farm King's relied completely upon the agreements, that means exclusively. That's an inference that they are asking this court to draw, contrary to the judgment, and that's not appropriate. All of these, of course, these findings go directly to the fundamental unfairness prong of piercing the corporate veil. I don't believe that appellants are challenging the legal proposition that fraud is a basis for finding that the fundamental unfairness prong has been met. That was, you know, the legal authority for that was addressed by the court, and they don't challenge that. The court noted that Webby intentionally misrepresented himself as a well-financed suitor, bragging about Big R, despite knowing that he had $29 million of debt finance liability, and that he enhanced that image by agreeing to the financial representation in the SBA that he knew was untrue. But Farm King did not. And considering the frequency with which he shuffled the entities whose names were changing in all of the documents, you know, throughout the negotiations, it is fundamentally unfair to allow him to use that intentional and fraudulent activity as a corporate shield, saying, well, I was only acting on behalf of the corporations, which exist only to the extent that he operates. He is the only individual associated with the operation of these companies. I see that I'm out of time. If you have other questions, I'd be happy to answer them, but I won't go over my allotment.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant, any rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. Sarah Crippen again on behalf of appellants. A couple of things. I can't tell you for certain whether the reliance word comes up in our opening brief. It came up in our reply in specific response to the fraud and the inducement argument that Farm King made. And it goes to that reliance issue. The other thing that I think is missing from Mr. Landon's analysis is the undisputed fact that Farm King won a contract claim. So all of these issues that we're talking about, representation of financial capability, the closing dates, which they talk about, Farm King won breach of contract and breach of good faith and fair dealing claims. I think Mr. Landon also has sort of...
Well, just to be clear, the case law is pretty clear that sustaining a breach claim doesn't preclude a fraud claim by the principal.
But I would submit, Your Honor, that the facts supporting them, what it does prohibit is entering judgment in fraud for the same facts that constituted the breach of contract. And that's our position. This is a contract case.
Well, except for the fact that the contract case can be built, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, can be built on the district court's conclusion that the contract falsely asserted that there was in fact financial capacity for the corporation to enter the company to enter the deal, and a separate fraud was Mr. Webby promoting the financial wherewithal, his own financial wherewithal, to back up the deals, regardless of which one of the entities would be named in the ultimate documents and ended up in the closing. Correct me if I'm wrong about that.
That's exactly our reliance argument, which is set out in some detail in our reply. That's a fraud in the inducement argument, which there clearly was no reliance. We can have a dispute about the dictionary definitions of completely and exclusively. But Mr. Sievers said we relied completely on the contracts.
We could have it. I don't know that you'd win the argument because those words are certainly distinct.
But Mr. Williamson and Mr. Sievers also both testified we could have walked away. We didn't walk away because we got the contract language of Section 7.05. That is what we relied on and gave us comfort. That's the transcript at pages 66 and 70 is Mr. Williamson. The transcript at 599 is Mr. Williamson telling Mr. Grimsrud, we want more. We want a personal guarantee. And I appreciate the risk that if we go into this, the only recourse we'll have will be against these shell entities.
But in response to the request for personal guarantees, I think the record does support the idea, the testimony, that there were assurances that were repeatedly made. And, you know, obviously, if you're a buyer, you could say we wanted a personal guarantee, but we were just convinced by the charisma of the buyer and the repeated insistence that, look at all these other deals, look at this huge deal I made. I purchased something much larger than your company. Of course, I have the financial wherewithal here. What's wrong with that position?
That would be great if that's what the record supported, but the record doesn't support that, Your Honor. Respectfully, what the record supports is those statements were made. Maybe Mr. Webby was cocky about the ability of his entities to do these deals, but they didn't believe that. They didn't trust that. And the only thing that made them go forward was the contract language.
Except for the district court's finding that they did, in fact, rely upon those representations.
But that finding is contrary to the very specific testimony of the witnesses, Your Honor.
And that testimony, I think if I understood your argument accurately, hinges significantly on how we interpret the word and what inferences we might draw from the word completely, whether that's
There's additional testimony from Mr. Williamson and Mr. Sievers beyond the "we completely relied on the contracts" that says, why didn't you walk away as your lawyer threatened that you would do if you didn't get a personal guarantee? Why didn't you walk away? And both Mr. Williamson and Mr. Sievers testify, and this is in our briefs, because we got that language in the contract. I'm out of time. I wish I could have spent more time on the veil piercing, but we will rest on our briefs and ask that the court reverse the district court's findings as to the veil piercing and the fraud claims.
Well, thank you both for your arguments on behalf of your clients. Both of your clients should be very happy with the representation they've received. Very nicely done.